Well, thank you. Somebody didn't do it. Anyway, so I'm David Kirkpatrick. I'm senior editor for Internet and Technology at Fortune. And we're going to be talking about what is really my favorite topic, which is why the Internet matters so much, what is so big of a deal about what's happening there, what is so disruptive about what's happening there. And we have examples of a number of really powerful companies that are demonstrating why not only the Internet is a powerful tool, but why it really matters to other businesses that are, in many cases, not paying close enough attention. But I'm also going to try to include in the discussion a little bit about what the Internet can tell us about how we can solve other problems. Since the Ideas Festival is so hugely, as was brainstormed when we happened here three different times, about, you know, how can we collectively solve the problems of the world. And, you know, some might argue, and maybe some of our panelists will argue, that the Internet already is doing that to some degree. But even aside from what's happening already, we want to see what can we learn by looking at the Internet about where we can go with some of these big issues of democracy and climate change and mutual understanding that are, like Bill Clinton was so eloquently just talking about, and I have to say I'm still in his thrall. That interdependency stuff is something that really means a lot. So let me just quickly introduce the panelists. And from your left, Jordan Greenhall, who is the CEO of DivX, which is a public company. He'll tell you a little bit about it. It has a video standard and is a very, very inventive, serious technology company. Next to him, Chris Sacca, who's also with a very, very serious technology company, Google. Next to him, Mike Fitzsimmons, who's with DeliveryAgent.com, and what he's doing will surprise you, and you'll find it really interesting. And finally, Angelo Satira with DeviantArt.com, which is a website for artists that and a community for artists. So how many members do you have now?
5 million.
5 million artists creating their own social network on the Internet, and probably many of you never even heard of it. But this is the kind of thing that's going on the Internet. Communities of 5 million people are arising and becoming major social and economic forces, and many of us don't even realize it because we're not part of these communities. So let's see. Maybe Chris, you have the big picture. Have you caught your breath?
Sure, yeah.
So when you look at, you know, when you think about this question of why is what's happening on the Internet important? Can you take a really big picture view of that for us for just a minute or two?
Sure. I think what's been fascinating about the Internet is it has removed many of the obstacles that have traditionally stood in the way of problem solving or innovation. And that even in the first generation of the Internet, 1998, 1999, to start a company to solve a problem, you needed to get your hands on $3 to $5 million before you could write your first line of code. And so most problems were being solved by MBAs in the ether and PowerPoint presentations, you know, and you solved very liberally. Now, I think the Internet has really enabled folks to write code immediately, to start coding answers to problems, to build software, to go ahead and try and pursue solutions without having to raise that capital. And so what we're seeing is,
in other words, to apply software code to social problems, business opportunities, in a more rapid way.
But what it's enabled, though, is actually a new way of thinking about problem solving, which is saying, look, let's actually focus on user problems first. And since it doesn't really cost any money to get started, I don't have to go prove to a venture capitalist that I'm ever going to make any money doing this. And what we're seeing is a generation of problem solvers who work for impact, not for money. And we're saying, look, I want to try and tackle one of these problems. And they're actually starting with the problem and working backwards into a solution. And I think that is a paradigm that is started with the Internet. And I think we see the ability to apply it in other settings now, too.
Is that true inside Google as well, even though it's a well-established company?
I think Google is actually an example of a company that, despite taking venture capital, thought like that from day one. Larry and Sergey set out to build the world's best search engine without any idea how they were going to make any money. And it worked for them, and so now they're sticking to it. So now every time we start a new product, you're actually discouraged from thinking about how you'll make money with that product in the beginning, because we think that actually puts the blinders on. And there are other companies that may or may not be located in the Pacific Northwest that I think start with an existing revenue source and figure out how they can squeeze another incremental dollar out of a user and forget about the user experience.
That's Microsoft, if anybody's wondering.
I didn't say it, but yeah. No. But I think the way we do business is we
That's what he said it, I didn't. I'm just interpreting.
I think the way we build products is we really start with a user problem. So Gmail, for instance, we say, look, it's a bummer that you can't search over your mail. You have such a limit on webmail storage, and the conversations are so disjointed. And so we started with something that solved that without any idea how Gmail would ever make money, if it would make money. And I think taking those traditional binds off people when they're thinking about solving problems, cost, politics, you know, at Google, I have the freedom to start anything, even if it's going to piss off a partner of ours, as long as I'm doing it in the best interest of our users. And I think that's a paradigm that we are going to hopefully see leave just the realm of Silicon Valley and start being applied to solve problems in the political and social justice realm as well.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to hear specifically how you think that'll happen. But it's interesting that you think not only is it happening in Google, but entire companies are emerging with no need for capital and taking that attitude of let's solve a user problem, get a bunch of users, and figure out how to make money later. Like, Angelo, I'm curious, when you started DeviantArt, did you have a clear business model, or did it just sort of start arising kind of organically?
I think an entrepreneur typically has a, you know, an idea in mind that you know, this direction is going to lead us in, you know, either to a good place or to a bad place. So I think an entrepreneur's responsibility is to sort of say, well, this is a safe direction. But no, I mean, I think that, you know, DeviantArt launched out of a need for artists to connect on the internet. And, you know, we started the business with $16,000. We didn't take an investment for, you know, 7 years. So, you know, we grew to a top 100 or I think probably 90 web property before we felt the need to take some sort of an infusion. And even then it was, you know, in specific to move in a particular direction. You know, the platform that we built, which enabled, you know, 5 million artists to connect and share their artwork and interact in a society which was previously completely unavailable to them, you know, and specifically, like, sort of, for me, it's the Mike Correo example. Mike Correo was an artist who was in my high school class in, you know, science or homeroom and a couple of other classes, and the completion of every class, he had some new beautiful work of art. And, you know, you'd walk by Mike Correo and you'd say, wow, Mike, that's great. You know, and we were his audience. And it was sort of the three or four people who were secure enough to sort of share an opinion in seventh or eighth grade, you know what I mean? So, that were his fans. And eventually he got picked up into the newspaper. And you know, DeviantArt for me was is sort of a representation of every Mike Correo finding every Mike Correo and Michelle Correo in the world and connecting under in sort of one environment for the first time. You know, a lot of the stereotype about that particular Mike Correo personality would be, you know, that person was just alone before, living their life, sort of be fascinated with what they loved. And the internet is a catalyst that in all probably genres and topics brings people together. If entrepreneurs and if empowered individuals at any age, you know, probably starting around 12, build it and make it a place that you know, meets with the ideals of that type of a community.
How did you end up making? I mean, you do make some money now. What is your revenue model today?
So, you know, I think what made a lot of sense in 2000 at that point in time, advertising was completely outside of the question. So you had to really put your ear to the ground and figure it out. And, you know, one of the strongest revenue streams that I generated for the business was a subscription model. And it was very simple. We're a software company. And as you're developing software, you have to make all your features available for free, except you can build a subscription package and sort of say, well, some of this stuff that makes it a little bit more exciting. Like maybe in the early stages it was, you know, you could see DeviantArt with small thumbnails, but to get big thumbnails or better search, you know, better features and functionality to find art, you can charge for that sort of stuff. So long as the basic service is available for free, you know, you can theoretically build a subscription model and then subsidize that with, you know, if you have a community that's like DeviantArt, which has a particular purpose, which is art, you know, the proliferation of a community of artists and art, you can, of course, very easily sell artworks and, you know, build a print program, which we did in 2002. And, you know, you basically look at the needs of the community, you start providing services and offerings that are interesting to that community, and you can build a business on the internet. I mean, you know, you have PayPal. If you don't know how to set up a merchant account, you can. It's very, very simple just to begin collecting money. If you have engineers, it's very easy to build systems that people are willing to pay for.
So many of your artists are selling their art on the site?
Yeah, approximately 8% at this point in time.
And do you get a cut of that?
Yes, we do. We have we get approximately a 50% of net cut, which we modeled after galleries.
And this is not your first internet company, right?
That's right.
Talk about the first one.
My very first one, I started when I was 12. So, that was sort of it was a BBS for video games. It was a 40 phone line BBS with the T1 connection. Which
bulletin board.
Awesome
service,
back there.
Right.
BBS, yeah. But it was for the purpose of people playing games like Doom and Hexen and Heretic, which are sort of the olden day versions of Quake or Unreal or whatever. And you'd play over your modem. And again, it was a subscription-based model. You actually paid for credits or you paid for an unlimited subscription. So that's sort of where I probably got the notion for DeviantArt. But that was when I was 12. When I was 15, I built a music community, which really started out of a passion of just for MP3s. And, you get in trouble. I mean, if you're sort of one of the early adopters of MP3s, I mean, you're probably either an early adopter and an interesting entrepreneur from that perspective, or you're just a pirate. Depending on how you look at the story, that's kind of how I started. Really meeting people and building my network. But so DMusic was a blog essentially, which there was no blogs back then, which led you to where you could download lots of music. That became really, really popular. And then it was sort of transitioned because we were the first people or one of the first two companies to get contacted by the RIAA. And that just sort of, the company got acquired by Michael Ovitz in 1999.
How old were you then?
I was 18.
Okay, sorry. Just had to get that out.
I was really 17, but I had to graduate college.
Mike Ovitz bought his company when he was 17. Anyways. Yeah.
I worked at Artist Management Group for 2.5 years. And that's really where I kind of gained a lot of perspective on just artist management, right? I mean, we were working with Cameron Diaz and Leonardo DiCaprio. And, I get pulled out of high school, and 2 weeks later, I'm sort of, helping Cameron with a project she was working on back then. And, just sort of really starting to see how old school sort of Hollywood thinking was just not going to fit into everything I knew at all. So I started coming up with strategies for which companies were interesting, and so we made a number of investments into GameSpy, into Ask Jeeves, and a few other things. But I soon wanted my freedom to build I didn't want to be restricted by Hollywood, and I sort of started looking at DeviantArt, and I started saying, well, look, What excites me about that is you look at DeviantArt one way, which is the way that everybody looks at it, and you go there and you browse art and you find artists, or you are an artist and you submit art and find a peer group. There's also another way to look at it, which is that there's a massive society of people. They're rating artwork, they're interacting with artists, and as a result of that, using geo-targeting technologies, I pretty much know where the best artists in the world are, by and large, due to popularity. Down to a kilometer anywhere in the world. So, the value of that is fascinating from how the internet and, some people call those social networks, even though it's not really so much of a social network, it's more of a society of people coming together, and they have a particular focus. That focus is not available to them. That peer group is not available to them in their everyday lives.
Not to be too personal, but how old are you today?
26.
So he's got 5 million. It's pretty amazing. I think that his story, it tells us a couple things. One, it tells us how powerful the internet is as a platform that allows creative people to start a business really in a fundamentally new way, without money, just with a good idea and some real smarts. But I also think it's a classic, up to now, American story that really only here have we really had people who had the sort of soup of factors that allowed these things to happen. But I think maybe the kind of discussions we have here at Ideas Festival would lead us to hope that, and actually hypothesize that the answer is it is starting to happen in a lot of other countries, that people like Angelo are having similar revelations and creating huge businesses. Certainly in China today, there are internet businesses started by very young people, some of whom have over 100 million users. Mike, now you have a business quite different. Just quickly tell us what your business is and tell us who you're disrupting.
Sure. One thing before I say that, I think is a relevant data point, because we talk a lot about these organic, and your story is a unique story, and I think we can get caught in this trap of thinking that's easy to replicate. It ain't easy to replicate. If you look at venture financing last year, 126 companies were, or Web 2.0 companies were venture financed. That was 2x the year prior, 4x the year prior. 126 companies in 2006 were venture financed, Web 2.0 companies. That was actually an increase of 2x over the year prior and 4x over the year previous to that. Average investment was $5 to $6 million in those companies. That's the reality. Of those companies, in the last, if you just look at the last 7 years, the amount of capital required to achieve a liquidity event has increased every year since 2001. It's actually doubled since 2001. So I think there's a phenomenal story with these kind of cases, but there's also a grounding that we need to be sensitive to, that this stuff ain't easy. It does take capital. And
are you disagreeing with Chris?
Can I respond to that? I'd say in the last 2 years, we bought 60 companies. I'd say six of those have had values of more than $30 million. And so, and I'm an active angel investor. I rarely do a round where I infuse more than $50,000 to a company at a pre-money valuation, and usually between $300,000 and $600,000. And so I think the entire game has shifted from where it was 5 to 8 million or some, you know, 3 to 5 million to start, to where now we see kids through like the Y Combinator program who with $12,000 in 12 weeks are actually building companies that are ready for an A round. And so I actually think I've seen it shift all the way. And so now liquidity events, though, for some of you guys, I mean, Angelo's company is probably worth on the order of $500 million today. Maybe I'm underselling it. But I think we see a lot of teams that are building things in the proverbial garage with maybe $100,000 and coming to us for a liquidity event in the $5 to $10 to $20 million range.
Well, you're entitled to disagree. We don't have to resolve that. But unless you want, but no, I want you to talk more about.
Well, when he explains what he does, though, you'll understand why he's got a big company. And I think what you're doing is big. Yeah.
So what we do is, and the problem that we're trying to solve is a pretty simple one. I think if you look at traditional television advertising and the advent of PVRs and TiVos, you know, the statistics are pretty overwhelming. 55% of people don't watch, 55% of TiVo owners don't watch TV commercials anymore. Big business, you know, broadcast television ad spending alone is $15 billion, something of that magnitude. All cable and network advertising is, you know, $30, $40 billion, whoever you're listening to that day. So there's a big shift taking place. Advertisers are less satisfied with the effectiveness of the 30-second spot. So we're trying to help solve this issue, because we actually fundamentally believe, and we're not a big user-generated content company per se, but we fundamentally believe that premium content is hard to make, that the business models are under a significant amount of stress, and we need to help the Hollywood, the entertainment industry, find new revenue models. So what we do is pretty simple. We enable the actual television show networks, movie studios, record labels to actually connect viewers with the products that they see in the programming. So if you're watching a show like Desperate Housewives, through our technology and platform, we enable the viewer to buy products that maybe Terry Hatcher is wearing, or get more information on the paint that's in her bedroom, crossing the gamut. So our core goal is to help the entertainment communities, our entertainment properties generate new revenue streams, create more value for advertisers, and create a compelling way for viewers of television shows to connect with products that they see in the shows.
My daughter, who's a big Desperate Housewives fan, is nodding furiously over there. Yeah.
So in our story is a little bit more traditional, and we are a venture-backed company. We've gone through 3 rounds of financing. Bootstrapped the company, got to $1 million in revenue on friends and family, very similar on an initial investment of $15,000, but then realized that in order to take this thing the full distance, we're going to have to go get some more capital. So we've raised about $35 million in capital. It's a business that'll do about $50 million in revenue this year, and growing rapidly.
But it's a software business though, and it's also an internet business, right?
Correct.
I mean, talk about quickly, where's the software and how do you use the internet?
Yeah, it's a pretty cool system. So actually, what we enable is the actual content producers. So when they're making a TV show, they use a set of tools that we've created, that it's an internet-based data collection tool. Literally, when they're dressing Terry Hatcher, they digitally catalog every single product that they use, down to the model and the brand of the shirt that she's wearing. So all of that data is fed into our system prior to the episode airing. And just to give you some context, an episode of a show like A Desperate Housewives has about 250 unique product exposures per episode. So there's an awful lot of inventory in that actual show and consumer interest in those products. So today we have over 125 television production companies, movie studios using this tool set to basically create these digital catalogs of every single product that they use when they're making the show. We then have a set of tools that we enable an online viewer of that content to connect with that product information. So if you think about this, You're watching the actual stream of Desperate Housewives on your video player. In the right panel of the actual video player, we can dynamically serve up all the product information relevant to that content that you're watching. It's a very simple
technology works. You also share some of the revenue when the sale occurs with the producer of the program or the TV network.
That's our core business models. We actually do a revenue share with the actual content producer, so with the studio, and that's what makes the whole thing work.
And who are you disrupting in that architecture?
So, I mean, the people that dislike us most are the network ad sales, the internal network ad sales guys, the guys that are used to selling. I mean, their upfronts, if you look at 2007, their upfronts were actually up 5% for, you know, ABC and CBS. So those guys are used to just selling big, you know, $10 million online packages to P&G and to everyone else. And we're coming in here and saying, hey, it's not about a 30-second spot, it's about the content itself. You know, forget about your 30-second spot. We can actually, you know, create a meaningful revenue stream out of the actual content itself. So the traditional advertising agencies, the ad sales at the network level are really the two constituents that dislike us most.
I think you're also taking a lot of guessing out of it. It used to be that you walk into these upfronts and on the basis of a preview for a show that's going to run in a few months, you have to be willing to fork over $1 billion in committed ad spend. And with what he's doing, it's actually based on the performance later. Like if the show's a hit, then you haven't really taken any risk. We're going to sell a lot of product. And if the show's a flop, again, no risk. You're not going to sell any product, and it's all revenue share based on performance.
One interesting thing that Mike didn't mention is that almost none or very small percentage of those products that he catalogs are actually paid product placements. They're just the products they happen to be using anyway, and then he goes to the company that made them and says, hey, your product's in Desperate Housewives, don't you want to sell some more of it? And can we help you do so? And they almost always say yes, right?
Yeah, and when we brought up the point earlier about the social change component of this panel, I'm not going to be able to help much with that. And I've got to be honest about the most recent campaign that we did. So we're starting to do deals directly with celebrities as well. So you see us weekly, and it's all written about what is Jessica Simpson wearing, what is Paris Hilton wearing. And so we have a deal with Paris Hilton where she tells us everything she's going to wear, and we sell that stuff to the public. And I got to be honest, if anyone saw the photograph of her walking out of prison, the jeans that she was wearing are from Paris Hilton's jeans line. So, you know, this thing has, you know, it has sort of no end.
We don't want to hear that. But how does... Now, yeah, I mean, that's probably the architecture of that is too complicated to get into right this second. But, yeah, is she making a lot of money that way? But I just want to know to really feel bad. Is she making a lot of money that way with that stuff?
You got to realize without us, they were making zero. That's the fact. So I don't know how you gauge a lot, you know, relative to
this
nascent
money
business.
That,
she's making money. It's an incremental revenue stream for her.
So the more publicity she gets for going to jail, the more she makes money from selling clothes. How do you like that?
Anyway. Mike actually mentioned at dinner last night that Jessica Simpson has the fourth most popular shoe brand in America right now. I had no idea.
I didn't know that.
That blew me away, yeah.
Clara, did you know that? No, she didn't. Even the 15-year-old didn't know that. So, Jordan, first of all, tell us what DivX is and why it matters and where it might go. But also, you're a good big thinker about this internet stuff, so... Try to maybe put what we've heard so far into context a little bit, if you would.
Yeah, so just remind me to try to figure out exactly why and how what Mike's doing is going to be significant in social change, because I think it actually is. It's going to take a few seconds for us to come together.
Well, if anybody can figure it out, it'd be you. Okay.
Well, I think it's actually symptomatic and emblematic of a much broader phenomenon having to do with data and tracking data, but let's, in 45 seconds, I think it'll be clear. What we did is we started out with a particular idea in place. There was a problem. It was needful that the internet that we all knew back when we were on BBSs and stealing music and stuff like that was going to be good as a way to distribute media, particularly video media. And what that meant was that you had to find a way to actually create a technology layer that would enable people who were publishing video and people who want to consume video to be able to have that move very seamlessly from, say, the point of publishing to the living room, to the television, or to a cell phone, or to your laptop, very smoothly, very easily, and obviously with a very high degree of quality. Right? So what we had to do is we had to go out and create a universal, ubiquitous standard adopted by hundreds of millions of people around the world and by tens of thousands of major companies. And we had to do it with actually spending no money. So that was the problem that we set out to solve.
We're up against a monopolist too.
We were up against Microsoft, who was the other major competitor.
Thought I'd point that out.
And I was actually then, I think, exactly how old Angelo is right now. So, you know, that you can see the difference, the sort of weathering that's involved in doing that. And what we were creating was pretty sort of hardcore stuff. It's sort of these things called algorithms and codecs and technologies that have to go into silicon. So it wasn't, you know, real, you know, sitting on top of the internet, things that could flow very, very rapidly. But nonetheless, we had a hypothesis that you could still use the nature of the internet as a communications medium and as a sharing medium to create a standard. Now, the folks who did this right before us was an entity that you've probably heard of called DVD. The DVD forum. The DVD forum solved the problem of creating a standard that enabled media to be moved out in physical discs into your living room. I'm sure everybody here is familiar with DVD. That consortium consisted of all of the largest studios in the world, all of the largest consumer electronics manufacturers in the world, and all of the largest retailers in the world, all collectively getting together, spending 5 years focusing on how to build a standard, and then lurching it out into the marketplace. Right? We actually did it ourselves in a period of about 6 months, with essentially no marketing spend or work on our part. What we did is we created the core technology, and I have to emphasize again, this is a very, very high-end technology. Right? Only a couple thousand geeks around the world could actually ever care about it. But the key was, I could get to every one of those 1,000 people, and I gave it to them for free. The very next day, they started coming out with variations on it and applications on it that were valuable to 1 million people. 6 months later, 50 million people had begun to interact with this particular new technology standard. They started creating content and sharing content, creating applications, creating utilities, incredibly autocatalytic, incredibly viral, and incredibly self-discovering. That is, we didn't necessarily have to know what exactly was going to be the killer app. We had to allow the marketplace to actually discover that for itself and give them the freedom to run with it. So now we sit at the end of 7 years with several hundred million people around the world to use our technology. More than 100 million physical devices sitting out in living rooms around the world that use the technology, and in fact created the de facto standard for high-quality media across the internet, and have made the internet an effective medium for distributing video. To kind of cross-coordinate, the people who don't like us are the cable companies, and on top of them, actually, the cable broadcasters themselves, because what we've created is an environment where anybody who wants to broadcast their media assets, their video, out to anybody can, in fact, now do it very, very cheaply. So you don't have to go out and cut a deal with ESPN or HBO or certainly not with a Comcast or Cox to get your content out there. You can simply choose to do it, and suddenly you're in the business, right? And then you can start seeing how that will link up with folks like Google, who will then find out a way for you to make money off it with advertising, or frankly, folks like Delivery Agent, who will find out a way to, like, hey, why does it have to be Desperate Housewives? Why can't it be the next video show that's created by the folks who created Desperate Housewives going straight to the consumer themselves? Right? So that's what the problem that we solved, how we solved it, and in some sense sort of a taste of what the consequences are. But what I think is, in fact, why I got into this business in the first place, which is very interesting about the internet space, is that we can all look around, and anybody here who's older than about 12 is aware of the fact that technology in general, digital technology in particular, has a significant tendency to change things, and to change them quite profoundly. It changes the fundamental assumptions about what's possible, what's capable at an economic level, right? Who can communicate with whom at what velocity. The entire entity of Walmart exists because of its ability to do supply chain optimization based upon databases and telecommunications. It changes what kind of ideas can be disseminated, what kind of ideas can be heard across on a global basis. I mean, billions of people communicating all the time. And the business that we're in puts us smack dab in the absolute white-hot cutting edge of that change. Right? We live in an environment where, in most cases, there either are no institutions that exist to solve the kinds of problems that we need to solve, so we have to make them up as we go along, very ad hoc, and Angelo can talk about how he solves the social problems that exist within this entire network of artists who daily deal with issues that are actually truly interesting and emblematic of some of the social problems that President Clinton is talking about that affect us on a global scale. Or the institutions that currently exist are immediately antiquated, and we have to deal with how do you move beyond the legacy consequences of ideas that made a lot of sense in 1950 that make no sense whatsoever in 2007. Right? So there's the disintegrating tendencies of free markets and disintegrating tendencies of high technology are an environment that we live in and thrive in every day. And as a consequence, when we cheated a bit. We had dinner together last night, and we had some very, very nice wine and sort of lubricated the conversation and discovered that a lot of ideas that we sort of consider to be obvious and rote are ideas that are potentially quite impactful because they're learned experiences that have been hardened through our collective of necessity of competition and collective necessity of actually giving consumers what they wanted, but solve a lot of very interesting problems in an environment that I think is typically becoming emblematic of problems that we're seeing across the board. I mean, global climate change, all the resource depletion issues that we've talked about, global terrorism. I think one of the most fascinating statements I've heard this entire conference was given by a gentleman at I think it was called Multilateral Politics for International Problems. And he mentioned that the most efficient entities right now in the world are the organized criminal entities that use highly distributed mechanisms to solve their problems. Well, guess what? That's what we do too. So, but we're good guys, and we can actually try to figure out how to use those techniques to solve those same problems in a positive way. But there's a whole series of things that are coming out of the pipeline that hit most of what we consider to be important in our lives, all of which are being affected by things that we live in on a daily basis. So some learnings that I think can be very usefully applied outward.
So, Chris, what do you think is the most positive thing the internet is doing for society?
I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and I was the first person to go to Georgetown University since my dad went there 25 years earlier from my hometown. When I first told my guidance counselor I wanted to go to Georgetown, she got me a scholarship to Georgetown Christian College in Kentucky. And frankly, I grew up, you know, compared to the rest of the world with a shocking amount of social mobility, and yet still I was very lucky. I caught a lot of lucky breaks, and I worked hard. And I think what the internet has done is actually removed so many barriers and placed the onus back on individuals and the initiative they want to take. It's fascinating. I mean, you look at somebody like Angelo who literally was hacking at age 12, and he didn't have to have a connection to do that. He didn't have to know anyone, you know, famous. I mean, it's funny. My younger brother is an actor, and when he was just a few years ago, when he was at Tisch in the School of the Arts, his entire paradigm was like, okay, I'm going to put on a show, and hopefully somebody fancy will come see my show, and maybe I'll get to schmooze a little bit, and maybe they'll give me an audition, etc. Now he and his buddy put together videos that have essentially no budget. They just put together comedy videos. They post them to YouTube. They're seen by a few million people. And Bill Murray called him a couple months ago and said, hey, I want to do something with you. They're releasing something now. And it's very interesting. I think it has really shifted the opportunity back onto the individual and let it be a product of their initiative and their desire and their hard work. I mean, with that comes a lot of responsibility. It's easy to just be a consumer. It's easy to just sit back and to not necessarily take that initiative. But I think the internet also has taught us a lot about, there are a few characteristics. I think the internet is very nimble. I think, as we think about larger social problems and we start thinking about regulation, I've been lucky that in the realm of the internet, it is highly unregulated. And I think that has worked in our favor almost at every turn. There are a couple of places where the market, I think, breaks down and regulation might make sense. But the internet scales, and it helps us to think about solving problems that affect hundreds of millions of people. I think I've said before the one
or way, billions.
Billions, even. The one way to disappoint Larry and Sergey is to come to them with a solution to a problem that's too small. It's just the one way to get kicked out of the room. You know, like, there's no idea that's too stupid, but if you come with a small idea, you're ejected. And then I think it's also, the internet has shown us that it's self-organizing. Yeah. And the internet has shown that that we don't necessarily need rigid, hierarchical, class-based or financially-based leadership structures, and that the internet actually self-organizes, particularly around people who are motivated by impact, not by money.
Well, if the internet is disrupting industries the way, for example, delivery agent is disrupting, or among many factors, disrupting the conventional TV broadcast industry. Can we talk even more big picture about how the internet can disrupt the status quo, perhaps in positive ways, I hope, maybe in negative ways? I mean, for example, if the internet puts so much power in the hands of individuals, what is that going to mean? And I don't know if you want to talk about that, Angelo, since you're, you know, a social networking guy. Just to give a thought from another panel that I moderated today, I don't know if any of you were at it, but on corporate social responsibility, we had Walmart and Ernst & Young and a couple other companies on the panel, and Ernst & Young was saying how much the Enron scandal changed the business of accounting. And then, of course, Walmart was conceding that the public pressure that existed because of their not giving their employees, well, they don't, the medical insurance situation for their employees and locking their janitors in at night and was just part of the reason why they started getting more socially involved in the sense of broadcasting their green message, et cetera. And the point that I was making was that both of those things really were important, partly because the consumers now have the power to say, that matters to me. And as a result, companies like Walmart and Ernst & Young and Toyota and Motorola, the other companies on the panel, have to respond in a way they didn't before. So I guess one of the things that I find really interesting about the internet is trying to just think about what that process is going to mean going forward. I mean, and to really be totally pie in the sky and go all the way to the craziest thing that we could, I mean, and it isn't crazy if you listen to Bill Clinton. Really, ultimately, we can all acknowledge that it would be good in many ways if we had some kind of world government, right? Because then we'd have some authority could say, let's solve these problems or whatever. And we see no real pathway to getting there today. On the other hand, if you look at the fact that we have a planet that's getting increasingly wired, you have almost 3 billion people on cell phones are all getting internet connected, we have about 1 billion people on the internet, and those people have the capacity to interact and sort of vote on things in funny ways, you might get to a point when that community could begin to have some governmental implications. I don't know, is that crazy? Anybody agree with me on that?
I completely agree with you on that. I think that the internet is essentially one of the primary catalysts for globalization, global connectivity. I mean, it's just, that's what it's been for me. I mean, and that's really what's important for the perspective that I have on it. I think that there's a tremendous amount of care that we have to take as we sort of progress into building communities that get closer and closer to very important subjects. So I've been fortunate. I mean, I think, you know, I'll step out on a limb and I'll just say that I believe that I run perhaps the community on the internet which has more culture, more citizens, so to speak, than probably any other social network on the internet. Not by number, but by active participants and by people who are truly being impacted in a very, very meaningful, powerful way. And that is simply because I happen to have stumbled into a very, very, you know, art as a medium, right, is just non-existent for the past 20 years, except for film and music. But as it pertains to still art, paintings, and this sort of thing, there hasn't been a mechanism through which that could be centralized and brought to a very large audience. So by aggregating a large group of people who all have a particular focus, we model what looks like the United States of America. We model what looks like capitalism meets democracy. Only in place of money in capitalism, there's art, and our currency is art. So to just jump right into a very specific issue, you know, we had an issue not so long ago where we banned for a moment people from submitting art and photographs about animals that were dead, right? And that was a controversial subject. The reason that we banned it was not because we didn't want to allow that form of expression, but because specifically some users were actually hurting animals in order to photograph them. Right? It's a side effect. It's not DeviantArt. It's just a side effect of a very large group of people and, you know, the need to get attention.
Right? Very deviant.
Yeah, well, yeah, but I wouldn't associate the brand. I mean, deviant to us doesn't mean that. It means very simply to change from to differ from the norm. And that's what artists are, right? The artists bring a new perspective, and so from that way, in that way, they deviate from what you'd expect to see. And that's the point of it. You know, that's what I think artists aspire to, whether they want to brand themselves deviants or not. But in this particular small instance, you know, we had to come up with how are we going to respond to that? Because if I'm blocking the ability for a citizen to contribute into the culture of DeviantArt, to sort of you know, exchange the currency of art in the way that they see it, then, you know, I'm making that decision as a government body against many citizens of an art community. And I'm censoring. on that level. So, you know, how do I build a system within DVNR such that the community itself can help govern those types of decisions? And so we've started to really look at, you just have to go back, and it's not very complicated. You go back to your civics book and your social studies book, and I mean, it's not like, you know, advanced writing about this. It's actually just very basic. It's the very basic idea that when you pull together a proper society of people on the internet, you have to provide democratic means for resolution, and you have to put the time in. You have to let politicians from the community rise up. You have to listen to their needs. We built a community development department and artist relations department. Those are complete losses to the company, but they're complete requirements of running a real society. And so how that applies in an art community to everybody is that if an art community can accomplish that, then you can also do something very similar on almost any topic. And the topic that interests me, that I'm particularly concerned with, is politics and sort of a political community arising, and sort of the power of that is enormous. The way that it's initially going to be executed is already doomed to fail, because the thing is, we all know, you know, whether you're from Google or from, you know, you watch as many of these startups come up and you can't predict them, and by the time you realize they're there, they're already way on the trajectory of becoming number four on the Alexa ranking. So, you know, it's just very, very hard to stop something when it's going to happen. So the moment when that starts to really come about, what I'm concerned with is, in that moment, the Washington sort of PR machine and it will destroy that concept for the next 15 years. And the power of it, if it's done right the first time, could help solve a lot of problems.
The problem of it, just summarize again what the it would be in that situation.
A political, a community that's focused on sort of politics as they pertain to every individual member.
Well, certainly MoveOn.org is, things that have started, plus, you know, I'm thinking, you know, MySpace, which is, you know, a community approaching a claimed membership of 200 million, in that ballpark, that's what they claim. I don't believe it myself, but they have a lot of people on there, and they intend to have some kind of quasi-political primary among their members, which is interesting.
Dancing around, those are sort of initial things that start to invent the need for a market, and the thing is, the internet's a very, very big place, but it's also very, very easy to access any particular thing through a link. So you can build, you know, the reality is that if a topic is important enough, it will be its own place. It doesn't have to happen within MySpace. I don't think it will happen within MySpace. I think it'll happen on its own entirely. And I think that when the elements in the marketplace are there for it to happen, it'd be very, very important to watch and have, you know, people pay very close attention and get a lot of feedback and you know... It's moving very fast, and like Jordan said, we really are on the bleeding edge of what's going on in technology in a lot of senses. Being on the bleeding edge, you don't really have people to look up to necessarily. You have what your gut instinct is right on the line of what's going on, and you know, you have some obligation to communicate, hey, you know, I run a community of artists. When this, you know, when it becomes more serious, when the topic is more serious, with art, it's pretty serious. I've had $26,000 worth of private investigator fees, due to, you know, so many side effects of being in the middle of a community like that, and you know, 1% of 1% of 1% of any large group of people, kind of dangerous, you know. So you know, when the stakes are much higher, and when something like that is there, you know, it it just has a tremendous potential to have a wide impact on us.
Yeah, I take a little issue with the notion of like that a world government is inevitable, and I think...
Well, I didn't say inevitable. I said, in my opinion, desirable, but that's just me.
Yeah, I'm not even sure I would consider it desirable at this point, because I think that artificially imposing a construct like that actually tries to preordain a result that I think could actually occur organically, and actually does occur organically. A lot of problems on the internet are solved organically, some by treaty, some by informal bodies, standards bodies. But I think the problem I'd want to focus on solving first is using the internet to enable wholly informed decision making. I think we've seen, you know, advertising is incredibly effective at influencing consumer behavior, not necessarily always used to make informed decisions. And I think we could use a lot of the lessons we've learned from advertising to help make more informed decisions. Linda will, already hates me for mentioning this, so I'll mention this bottle of water, for instance. So we can talk all we want about the carbon footprint of delivering this bottle of water from Fiji to here for me to consume it. Not even the amount of oil that goes into creating the bottle, but just the amount of oil that it takes to transport the bottle to here. But it never really sunk into me until somebody sent me a picture where they'd calculated how much oil it actually takes to move that bottle. Then they poured that oil into the bottle. And it looks like the top six of the bottle is just filled with oil. And that impacted so many of my senses at once that it made it physically impossible for me to drink water from a bottle like this anymore, because it tastes like gasoline to me. And it's deeply impacted my consumer behavior, and I think it's driven demand. And I think instances like this are starting to impact demand. And so I think about Mike's company, for instance, and though Mike is selling Paris Hilton jeans right now, there's no reason that Mike's company couldn't be used to really be a deep intelligence and tagging engine for all the content that's being presented on TV. Or he could start doing Charlie Rose episodes. And you know, the no-brainer would be to make it easy for you to buy the book that you see. But then each and every issue that comes up, go ahead and provide you links and ways to get involved and to be active in that issue and to dive into deeper information and be more informed and to make those decisions. And I think you'll see that if we build a paradigm where we start taking into account the full externalities of our buying decisions, and we're equipped to do so, I think you'll see the demand side will actually do this in a way that regulation could never do.
But why is the internet especially useful in doing that, just for people who might not quite understand the internet's role?
Because, do you want to take a shot at it?
I'm sorry. Whenever somebody uses the word internet, my brain sort of explodes.
Yeah.
By definition, the internet is almost everything that's interconnected in some way, right? So don't think about the internet as that thing that has a pipe that goes to the back of your computer used for email. That is one very minor manifestation of the internet. The internet is people using RFID to tag clothes. Internet is people being able to, you know, watch on little type pads, auto-generated blogs. I mean, the internet is literally all communication media interconnected and auto-dynamically generating the results. So the answer to your question is the internet is simply the manifestation of exactly the environment that we're talking about. It's almost a useless word now. I'm going to steal your time, Chris.
Oh, go ahead.
Because I wanted to get back to why Mike's changing the world.
And start thinking of your comments and questions, because we're going to hear those momentarily.
So there's a concept that these two French philosophers that I think are some of Chris's favorites, a guy named Deleuze and Guattari, wrote about in the late 80s called control. And control is very different from what a lot of us think is being controlled. Control, what most of us think is being controlled, is sort of being constrained. What they talked about control was the ability to engage in very subtle and very oblique manipulations of dynamic systems to generate results that are very difficult to predict from the manipulation that you engage in. So this is where, you know, you've heard of the famous butterfly effect, where a butterfly flaps its wings and creates a hurricane in Africa. Imagine that I could actually predict that by creating a butterfly flapping its wings in a particular location at a particular time, I could in fact create a hurricane in Africa, right? That's control. And for control to be effective, you have to have an enormous amount of data, an enormous amount of ability to track what's going on in that data flow. And one of the things that is simply going to happen, unless we have some sort of, you know, significant collapse of the energy infrastructure, is that data, right? So one of the things that Mike is doing is, in fact, something that should blow everybody's mind, right? He's tracking every single piece of material object that is being exposed to our brains through conventional media, right? So he's going to know what everybody saw and what they interacted with what they saw. And what he'll be able to track is the velocity and the shape of the network that disseminates these ideas through our social networks. So it's not simply the fact that Paris Hilton sold a lot of jeans. At a certain point in time, he's going to actually be able to show in colored intensity graphs of who talks to who, whose decisions make other people make decisions about what they're going to buy and what that topology looks like. So you can actually look on a graph and say, Paris Hilton is here, suddenly poosh, this idea comes out in this particular velocity. And that kind of information will give him or other people the ability to start engaging some very interesting forms of control. And there's a book that came out recently that caused most of the folks that I work with to actually kind of go, yeah, so what? But I think it's quite interesting. It was called Freakonomics. Right, and Freakonomics is something which is fully entrenched in the mindset of folks who work in the business that we work in, because you have to come and assume that every one of your assumptions is almost certainly wrong. Right? You just don't know what reality bears, even at an ontological level. Right? You think that something is an object. It's obviously not. Right? It's a process that's formed by some sort of causal relationships. And those processes can change, and that object can go away. So what you have to do is you just have to sort of throw your net out there and track the data and see what the results come back as. And don't go too far ahead. Right? Solve a very small problem, track the data, come back in, solve a problem, you know, track that out and come back in. And that's a mechanism that we should sort of all begin to start wiring into ourselves as a fundamental mechanism for how you solve problems in the go-forward universe, when control becomes the primary way that power imposes itself across the entire social field. So, Mike, in fact, you are changing the world, and in fact, in a relatively significant way.
Well, back to your other question about why the internet is set up to help solve some of these issues. I think that the real answer is it should be cheaper. And from my perspective, I spent a good bit of time philanthropic work, and I worked for I was an advisor for a philanthropic venture fund for a stint. You know, we would take five companies a year, give them each $1 million, treat them like for profits, hold them to new critical success standards, the whole bit. Every single one of those things trips up because it runs out of capital. That's just the reality of the situation. And that's my big $1 million question for this. If there's not a sustainable economic business model to support these endeavors, it's going to be difficult to make it all happen. And your point as to how we could change the world, sure. I mean, we could do all kinds of cool things. You know what, though? There's no economic incentive for me to do that, for my board to do that. And it gets to your previous point about the learnings of these types of companies and how they could be translated to the change that we're trying to make.
Oh, but, you know, the kind of way that internet companies work, you might decide to give your software to a separate entity, a nonprofit, that would do it for shows like Charlie Rose and track, you know, ideas rather than products. And so you could have an RSS feed for all the TV shows that had, you know, segments that dealt with, you know, global poverty or whatever.
I totally agree, but it's the question of who that company is. I've been through this too many times with those companies and those great entrepreneurs with great ideas that want to change the world and simply can't get out of the gate because where's that financing coming from? Where are they creating their infrastructure? And I think it's a real problem that we sort of sit here and pontificate about how we're all going to change the world, but the reality of those world changers is these aren't new ideas. People are having town hall forums talking about big issues and wanting to mobilize. You know, and that's the reality. It's not like I think there's a piece of this puzzle that's missing for me that I think isn't going to happen on its own.
I guess I disagree a little bit. I'm a little more optimistic about this. And I think to play off what Jordan was saying on Freakonomics, I think one of the big advances made in this, and what I consider to be actually a new era of data-driven intellectualism, is that there is a grand distinction being made between causation and mere coincidence or correlation. And that I feel like as I look at problems of social justice or look at problems of environmental concern or look at problems of poverty and hunger and disease, I feel like we have a generation of people that is really looking past trying to mitigate symptoms and really look to deep root causes. And I think that is particularly characteristic of this new generation of social entrepreneurs. And I think, you know, we see amazing examples coming out where instead of treating lung diseases that are a result of poor air quality in India, we have folks who are finally doing very, very cheap, actually. It doesn't take a lot of capital to kind of do an informational-based study and find out, you know what, one of the leading causes of lung-based diseases is outside the United States is the fact that most of the world still heats their home with kerosene, and kerosene is just dirty. It's just a nasty fuel. But not only does it burn people's houses down at an alarming rate, but it actually creates these really nasty environments in which to breathe, at least all this asthma. And we could go ahead and build a fund that actually hands out inhalers to poor kids, or we could actually work on LED technology, which tends to be very, very cheap, and distribute this to the masses so that they can power their homes with clean burning, really efficient LEDs and get rid of the kerosene. And so I actually see a new push towards, let's actually do investigational work. Let's really look at what the root causes are. We've even seen this in just the root causes of terrorism. I mean, if you think about like what motivated the 19 hijackers, they weren't poor, they weren't particularly religiously pious, they were generally apathetic people. But we see some really cool research coming out of Harvard right now that's showing some brain chemistry where it may have been correlated to the rise of the first video images available on Al Jazeera that showed their people being persecuted by Israelis within Palestine. Amazing, amazing data that I think doesn't actually take millions and millions of dollars to fund. It's in the hundreds of thousands of dollars level, and it is achieving brand new levels of understanding that are enabling us to go ahead and target root causes and not just be stuck in the mire of churning money through symptoms.
Well, this idea of data-driven decision-making being, you know, intrinsic to the internet is really interesting, and its impact, or the way that it can move offline and into other arenas, is demonstrated by what happens when technology and internet companies or entrepreneurs start their own foundations. Like, you know, the Google Foundation, which has, couple billion dollars worth of assets now, probably, is trying to address health issues with a very data-driven approach. And even your nemesis, Bill Gates, the reason why he chose to devote his foundation.
It's not foundation. Him, it's his company, by the way. This company is the nemesis.
The company,
I think Bill does amazing things with this foundation.
He does. Well, that's what I'm talking about. The foundation is devoted to healthcare in the developing world because his very data-driven approach to analyzing where his money could have the most impact led him to that, and it's why he's having such an enormously powerful impact. Questions, comments? Go to the mic. Please identify yourself.
My name is Matt Spence. My question is, I mean, you've seen a lot of these companies start up, a lot of fail, a lot of people aren't sitting up here where you guys are. I mean, are there some things that you see make a difference between what some of these things work and why they don't? I mean, I know it's a big question, just, I mean, is it ideas, is it the entrepreneurs? I mean, you talked about all these entrepreneurs and public service groups that you've tried to fund and they've continually failed again and haven't really gotten some traction. Are there some things that you guys have seen that have made the difference?
Are you talking in the social entrepreneurial realm or just startups generally?
I guess both, but I guess take whatever cut of it you feel like you'd like to.
You mean a rule of success for internet companies?
No, I mean...
What, a formula?
That would be great. But I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, like, what you guys...
And we'll go to John Doerr for that. Sorry.
I'll just give my perspective for
just community social networks. I mean, I think the primary mistake, very simply, that people make is being presumptuous. People think they understand how to go, you know... I won't use any examples, because... People believe that they understand a community of people that they want to entertain, and they just very simply don't. I think one of the best rule of thumb is that if it's organic, it's more likely to work.
I mean, let the community decide what they are going to achieve collectively.
Well, I mean, yeah. I would sort of even extend it to a larger principle, which is something that, frankly, I think meshes very closely with what Mike was talking about, which is one of the rules of thumb that I certainly have used in the businesses I've created in the internet is ruthless efficiency. I mean, if somebody comes and says, okay, I can do that for $50,000, I'll come back and say, okay, you've got $5,000, give me 95% of it, and we'll ask questions later, right? And you can't help it, because the companies that are, in fact, successful are the ones who are ruthlessly efficient. The internet is just massively corrosive around that, and if you try to reify concepts that create value bubbles that aren't really generating anybody any value, they get routed around very quickly. And if you're the entrepreneur who's more aggressive and more capable of getting more efficiency out of your techniques and processes, you're just going to get further and further ahead. Now, I would say that the reason why so many successful internet companies tend to use organic techniques is the same reason why so many biological organisms tend to use organic techniques. They're just more efficient. And where they're not more efficient, you'll see them using different techniques. And it's literally being very, very nimble and capable of figuring out what's going to be the most effective, most pragmatic, most efficient way to get from point A to point B as quickly as possible.
Well, I think another aspect is just that, particularly whether in the venture world, whether it's for-profit or non-profit or just in the startup community generally, is we're swinging for the fences. Like, there's nothing I hate more than the prospect of being stuck in a business that's in a cycle of incremental change where we're eking out 5% a year improvement. That just bores me, and I think it'll atrophy my brain. So as things mature and get to that stage, I'd rather go on and take on a new, unreasonably sized problem where I have a high probability of failure. And I just think that's what fuels this generation of entrepreneurs.
Just before we move on, you know, this thing about communities makes me want to mention to those of you who don't think about the internet every day, you know, people wonder what is Web 2.0? And I heard it defined well by the guy who invented the term, Tim O'Reilly. And he says Web 2.0 business is any business that is more useful the more people who participate in it. And that is kind of, if you look at, to some extent, Google, certainly something like MySpace, Facebook, Twitter, Delicious, or any of a bunch of new kinds of internet.
But also the cell phone.
The cell phone. That's a great example, right. And so communities really are what internet businesses are about. So when you talk about then this issue of the community determining what it will do together in the businesses, it's just a background point I wanted to make. Go ahead.
I'm Mathis Wackernagel with Global Footprint Network, and the question I have for you, I would like to hear more about your visions and dreams about how new internet technology can advance social change, and I would like to put it in the context of two dilemmas. One is that I believe the big power of the internet economically has come from cutting transaction costs. Historically, it costs about 50% for retailing stuff, to produce stuff to bring them to the consumer. Now, with internet, essentially, it's nearly free to bring to link producers and consumers. So the internet may have given a larger advantage to economic forces than to social forces. So that's kind of one of the problems. But that's why I want to hear what your ideas are. How can we make that link to social change? The second problem is what Carl showed yesterday, that the, just to take your statistics, that the, a picture of the, how's it called, the Brat, the Angelina baby, how's it called?
Oh, the Brangelina.
The Brangelina baby.
Yes.
People's Magazine paid $10 million for it, and getting social stuff on the internet is much, like, is, people's attraction to data is just not as strong as to kind of emotional stories.
Sure.
And so while the internet is excellent at bringing data together, it's not really what people are looking for. So looking at these two challenges of the economic advantage of the internet, how what kind of tools do you envision that internet can provide for social change? Just going wild into the future.
Can I address the first part of your question? I think that the answer to the internet being a vehicle for social change is actually a conditioned precedent, which is nobody's on the internet yet. It is still widely unavailable in the United States, and that's reprehensible. We live in a country where we're 16th or 17th in the world in broadband penetration. Half of Americans have access to broadband only by one or zero broadband providers. We pay too much for too little. It's controlled by a duopoly in this country. We haven't had any serious internet policy, forgiving any FCC chairman who are in the room, in a long time. And I think as I see the proliferation of internet and the widespread effects it has in communities and throughout Europe and Asia where it is available to everyone, you start to see that access to information, you start to see that social mobility, you start to see it a truly democratic vehicle for change that we don't see here. It is classist. We have digital haves and digital have-nots, and until we address that, we are going to continue to widen that gap.
Well, that's much truer on a global basis even than it is in the United States, too.
Sure, let's think domestically, but you start thinking around the rest of the world, and it's interesting, if you talk to anyone, I saw Jonathan from Motorola here earlier, I'm not sure if he's still here, but when they start developing handsets for the rest of the world, it's funny, because this, for me, is one of five or six connectivity devices I have. I don't really rely upon this thing as my lifeblood, but when you start building a device for someone in another world, even if it has very limited throughput, less than a dial-up connection to the internet, or maybe just SMS text-based messaging, that is their connection to the world. And it turns out that a lot of the phones they're building for the developing world are actually more feature-rich, and the users of those devices use more of those features than you and I ever will, because we have such an amalgam of devices here. And I think that's an interesting question as you start thinking about the precious resource of connectivity. It's funny, even as I get spoiled and say, look, I've only got 6 megabits now, I should get 100 megabits per second now, there's a massive difference between zero and something than between the 6 and the 100 that I'd like to have. And I think that is a condition precedent challenge that we have to solve before we can really see the internet realize its full potential.
Yeah, we actually spent a pretty substantial amount of time thinking about that problem. And I think in true internet fashion, we decided that we were only going to pick one thing, because if you could get only one thing done, what would it be? And obviously we wanted to pick the one that had the highest degree of leverage. And the one thing that we focused on was engagement, because obviously one of the things the internet is truly, truly good at is inter, and that connects people with each other. And one of the things that we discovered in our own environment was the simple fact of engagement caused a dramatic increase in participation and a dramatic increase in optimism of the people who are involved in our extended community. And that by itself creates an upward building positive feedback loop vector, which by hypothesis will tend to create beneficial effects. So we spend most of our time when we're thinking about social change just trying to find ways to enable people to become more engaged, more connected, and more able to express themselves and get their expressions back to other people and get feedback. And that's kind of like nutrition, right? Nutrition. If you have good nutrition, then lots of other good positive things follow. If you are engaged, then lots of other good positive things follow.
My name is David Jones, and I think I'm maybe following up a little bit on the same theme, but I wanted to try to broaden the definition of revolution a little bit. A lot of us have spent much of the time here talking about either education or healthcare. And at least domestically, these are really broken systems. 30% of the kids don't graduate from high school. A much higher percent don't get education that prepares them for the world. We all know the trends of obesity and all the lifestyle-related diseases. And I would point out that those are not only unwired trends. Korea's got a very, very fast-growing obesity problem. So really the question for you guys is, do you have any insights here? I mean, 50% of our population doesn't vote. Clearly, connectivity and involvement in a way around apathy are vital. But what kind of insights do you have to how to attack these big structural social problems?
I think we're a consumer-driven culture, and that as many times as I've tried to think, and I listened to Friedman talk the other day about how he's convinced that that there is this really efficient marketplace that will ultimately drive green back into the supply chain somehow because it's efficient. And I actually think that's hogwash in the next 15 years. I don't think that the full externalities of creating a product with all of the green impact are baked in yet. And that's why we've moved all our manufacturing to China. That's why it's the dirtiest place on earth right now in terms of air quality. And I don't think we take any of that into account when we price the goods that we buy back from them. And I'm not sure that the marketplace is actually equipped right now to both assess what those costs are and build those costs back in. So I'm actually a little bit of, maybe optimistically pragmatic here in that we have seen how effective advertising is. And I'm not speaking kind of Google advertising. I mean, so my girlfriend is a really successful advertiser for a well-known agency, you know, built kind of the Got Milk campaign and stuff like that. And I've actually seen how campaigns like that can dramatically change consumption behavior, can change how people think about their products. And it, being a consumer-driven culture like that, I actually would love to see people, creative people who understand psychology, who understand brain chemistry, start to feed back into the demand side of the equation and change consumer behavior then.
You mean about things like education and healthcare?
Absolutely.
I don't think it has a lot to do with the topic, but it's a very good point.
Yeah, I actually think that we still don't have the information, the ability right now to make intelligent decisions about what we eat. And so we can talk about it academically, and we can pass regulations that make McDonald's put their, you know, the caloric value of their menu somewhere hidden under a shelf in the restaurant somewhere, but we still don't factor that in when I go and buy a Big Mac at all. I devour that thing, and the advertising has somehow made me, you know, I'm feeling it, right? I mean, that's not their, like, I'm loving it, or whatever their slogan is. I've been programmed to like that transaction. I actually think we can use some of those same techniques, and we can use some of that same insight into how brain chemistry works and how consumption works to change behavior, and you'll see the rest of the supply chain will fall in line. And I think this happens not just for commerce, but for education, our attitudes towards education and personal advancement. I think it happens for personal health. I think it happens around community. I actually, maybe that's a little ruthless of me, but I think that's the path that
to works. Throw the internet back into that, you know, the existence of something like YouTube coming out of your company, Chris, makes it easier because in a way, you know, if a bunch of, you know, anybody can create a TV commercial on, and you know, using this data-driven kind of approach, if somebody wanted to bother, you could measure which ones were more effective. If you really wanted to have a contest or something, you know, this wouldn't be that hard using the tools that now exist because of the internet. So it is relevant.
And some of the most popular content on the internet year after year, if you take out porn, are the Super Bowl commercials. Every year, those are creative. You know, they're written dramatically, they're written comedically, they're filmed with some with high production quality, some with low. But it is amazing how compelling those messages are. So imagine if we harness the same techniques and the same psychology and insight-driven process to that, but to actually change user behavior on some of these deeper issues. I think it could actually be really powerful.
Hmm. And I don't want to beat this up too much, but the average 30-second spot costs $500,000 to produce. Right, so there's like that reality grounding. Where is this fuel going to come from, to make these things?
Because like, and I as I've gotten closer to this ad agency and stuff like that, and learned why it costs $500,000 to produce. They have a catering truck there. When I watch my brother make a video that 5 million people have seen, you know, normally he'll say like, look, I couldn't go to work this week. Can you pay my rent? It's so that I can, you know, his budget is along the lines of $500 to make something that millions of people will see ultimately. In fact, my brother, the way he's paying his own rent now is that companies have taken budgets that they used to take to the, you know, Shiat days and stuff like that. And they say to my brother, you know, they're probably getting the best of him actually, hey, for $20,000, will you build us a spot really quick that we can let go out on the internet? And he's happy to take the $20,000. It's more money he's seen in a long time. So,
yeah, for me, I'm a strong believer that you know, and I don't think the world's really quite caught up to this thinking quite yet, but I'm just a strong believer that every sort of emotional extension of yourself deserves its own service of connection to people who are feeling similarly in the moment that you're feeling whatever you're feeling. So whether that has to do with the environment, whether that has to do with healthcare, when you look at problems on a global scale, there's mass if you can have a tool to reach out and find the mass. And once you reach out and find that mass, you can mobilize it to help with laws or help with money or help with anything else. So, you know, for me, it's just really all about building proper communication tools,
proper environments for people to connect.
I want to just say something. If there's a, if the challenge is building more effective pathways between people for the exchange of ideas, feelings, and information, it's worth mentioning what Facebook has just done, I think, because as a journalist covering technology, I think it's one of the most dramatic developments that we've seen, which is that one of the largest social networks has decided to make itself into a platform that allows anyone, including anyone in this room, to build an application and put it on Facebook, and if any of their 28, 29 million members like it, they can start using it, and their network allows the viral communication of your preference that you're interested in that to go to your friends. These things can spread very rapidly. So we've got a new kind of tool for developing mechanisms to do things like what you just said that is more efficient than we've ever had, and I'm sure we'll get even better ones in the future.
That is definitely, at this moment, probably the most interesting one in the marketplace. I mean, I've been particularly impressed with the progress of Facebook, especially the platform play.
I know you two are, too, because we were talking about it last night.
Yeah.
Jerry Hosier, I'd like to keep the focus on healthcare and education, which by attending here this week, you see, if you didn't know already, both of those systems are totally broken, and there's lots of structural impediments because of teachers' unions, government, and all to accomplishing anything. But anybody at the individual level knows it's got to change. And it seems to me there's an incredible opportunity via the internet to take this virally right down to the individual and make change. And I wonder if any of you see real business opportunity in education. One teacher, one classroom, best practices don't get there. You have books. I saw a program where they said, send me an email and I'll send you what we do. What do you see as business opportunities in these two areas, which are giant social problems with lots of structural impediments, which I think the internet's ideally suited to bypass and change without having to go through the political process?
Yeah, I'm not going to speak to healthcare because that usually causes me to go into conniptions, but I'll take a swing at education because I think first you have to start posing the shape of the problem, because on the one hand you look at an educational system which is sort of broken, and it's been broken for a while, but the fact of the matter is the problem the educational system is designed to solve is radicalizing very rapidly. There was a session that I went to relatively recently where somebody put up some numbers showing that, for example, the average engineer who goes into college, 90% of what they learn is obsolete by the time they graduate from college, right? And that's accelerating at an exponential rate. So it's not just that the institutions of education that we've developed over the past 200 years are themselves sort of grinding themselves into bureaucratic obscurity, but it's also the fact that the problems that they were designed to solve are no longer really the problems that you need to solve. And so I would actually posit that we work backwards. I believe the fact of the matter is that you're going to have to start finding yourselves in an environment where content and capacity have to switch, that teaching content is useful only to the degree to which it inculcates some form of capacity. And by the way, that would obviously by definition include literature and art as much as math and science. Knowing the actual the actual facts of a given a piece of science is meaningful only to the degree to which it actually inculcates in you the capacity to think effectively about how one engages in scientific thinking and how one uses the existing techniques and technologies to discover that new information. So you look at things like Wikipedia. My daughter's 5 years old. My daughter is on Wikipedia. My daughter is learning things at a rate that is insane, and is learning things which, because it's Wikipedia, are radically up to date. But what's interesting is not the facts that she's learning, but the methodology she's using to become capable of learning. And the way that she's actually starting to build things like a built-in sense of dubiety around what it is she's actually learning.
Of what?
Dubiety.
What does that mean?
Skepticism.
Oh.
Right. So
dubiousness?
She does not take a particular fact as being canonical until she's able to cross correlate that with a variety of other facts.
Does she call it canonical? Does she use that word?
Yes, she does.
But can I I want to throw in an interesting fact. Did Ashraf leave? I wanted to hear what he had to say. But
yeah,
anyway, in my daughter's school, they won't allow the kids to use Wikipedia. I mean, this is a really interesting disconnect that's happened.
That the
educational infrastructure of the United States does not have faith in the internet community, and there are a number of other instances of it, but Wikipedia is the most dramatic. Almost every high school that I've ever heard of is explicitly telling their students, don't use Wikipedia because anybody can change that stuff. And they don't read the articles that show the accuracy is there. You know, they don't realize what it's all about. And it's the most, I think Wikipedia myself, along with Google, is the most powerful new information tool we've seen in decades.
Can I speak to healthcare really quick?
Just let me finish one thing.
Go ahead.
So, I mean, if I were to really take a swing at radicalizing education, I would just ask for two things. One, give me very, very effective 0 to 6-year-old education, which is focused obviously on building core capacities. And two, give every 7-year-old a laptop with a connection to the internet. Yeah. Give me those two things, I can give you better education than you got right now at a lot less money.
Good.
As I think about healthcare, really quickly, just to answer Jerry's question, I think that I've seen now a few big, deeply entrenched problems with many, many conflicted interests, and I have never really seen them solved from the inside. And so I think the two things that you require right up front to solve the healthcare problem, because it is completely broken, and yet no one is satisfied with it. No, there is no single entity that is satisfied and that feels like they're getting the most out of the system that they can. So I think it takes fresh eyes. I've made this mistake in the past in my career. I've hired 20-year veterans out of MCI to help me solve the telecommunications problem and realize that as much as they were even revolutionaries within their own company, they still have the blinders on. It's hard for them to see the object right in front of them sometimes, the solution right in front of them. And two, I think it takes entities that don't have those existing conflicts to sometimes come in and insert themselves, do some investigation, and pursue some change. And we've been doing some pretty exciting stuff in healthcare that I think empowers what I was talking about earlier, which is the demand side of the equation again. If we, working with others, can put you back in charge of healthcare, can put you in charge of your health records, can put you in charge of making the most informed decisions you can. I haven't met a patient with a disease who doesn't know just about as much as their doctor yet. I mean, you meet people who are dealing with cancer, who are dealing with chronic disease, and the tools that they now have at their disposal. I went with a friend to the hospital while they were learning about the state of their cancer, and it was amazing how left out of the conversation I was. It was like this kind of cancer nerd talk between a patient and a doctor at this level, and how it was fascinating how informed that person could be using the internet, using these tools at their disposal. And I think if we can marry that with control of your health records and put you back in the equation with control over who's going to provide your service, how they're going to choose what service, measuring the outcomes, I think that we can really revolutionize that.
Well, there is a lot of interesting entrepreneurialism coming out of the internet community directed toward healthcare, so I hope some of that might succeed. We've only scratched a very interesting surface. We've got to end, but thank you all. Thank you to the panelists.